All right, we're underway with the recording. All right, page 128, chapter 6, we'll pick it up at verse 18. So let's do a quick little review of where we have been in Daniel chapter 6. As far as the time frame goes, until we get into chapter 7, verse 4, we are in the Daniel's present day in the Babylonian exile. And in this particular chapter, we are right at the end of the exile. Babylon has been defeated by Medo-Persia. And the Jewish people are just about ready to return to the land of Israel after a 70-year exile. We are drawing to the end of our section of a chapters, chapter 2 through 7. We are in chapter 6, dealing with persecution, a reminder that the Jewish people survived any persecution thrown at us during the times of the Gentiles. Now, the persecution centered around the religious life of Daniel. Daniel had been elevated to a high ministerial post in the province of Babylonia and the city of Babylon. Jealousy from corrupt co-officials, and they wanted him out of the way. They couldn't get him out of the way based on his performance and his ethics, so they figured out they could get him out of the way if he just bring in conflict with his religion or with the state. So they cooked up this decree that they persuaded Darius to sign, stating that nobody could pray to anybody but Darius for 30 days. Darius fell for the trap, signed it. Daniel, very aware of the decree, didn't change a thing. He still continued to pray three times a day to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jewish people do not pray to a man. They pray to the living God only. And the conspirators knew exactly where to find him and when. So they found him at prayer. And here's an illustration of him on his knees in his upper room with the shutters open facing toward Jerusalem. This would be his evening prayers. And so we talked about prayer last 2 weeks ago. We talked about postures of prayer because this was a posture of prayer you don't see all that often in the church, nor do you see it all that often in the Jewish community anymore. And I mentioned that there is no prescribed posture of prayer in the Bible, no prescribed posture of prayer. It is the posture of your heart that is important, not the posture of your body. It is the direction of your heart, not the direction of your body that's important. It's not that you can't take on different postures, but God looks at the heart. He looks inside first. And if your heart is reflected in your posture, that's fine. So here we have an illustration of three different postures of prayer used in the first century in the kneeling position. On Yom Kippur, we saw a couple other postures of prayer. The high priest is standing. He's confessing his sins and the sins of his family over the bull, about to offer that bull for his own personal sins. He's in this picture, he is uttering God's personal name, Yahweh, and what's happening? We see these guys here are going flat on their face. They're prostrating themselves flat on the ground. Another posture of prayer that you don't see all that often, but no problem, it reflects their heart. And here is another picture of women praying, standing and kneeling. And again, I pointed out there's a very common element in these opening pictures, and that's the raised hands, right? Which is exactly what Paul was talking about in 1 Timothy 2:8. Therefore, I want the men in every place to pray, lifting up holy hands. This was a very common posture of prayer in the Jewish community and in the church in the first century. Not so common these days, but obviously very common when Paul wrote 1 Timothy 2:8. Again, this isn't seen very often in the Jewish community all that much today. Here's a picture of the Orthodox praying at the Western Wall. Some sitting, some standing, some wrapped in their prayer shawls, their talit, some without them. Here again, I showed you these pictures of these women praying at Warren's Gate, underground, in the rabbi's tunnel, in front of the blocked up Warren's Gate. On the other side of this gate, archaeologists tell us there's a big prayer hall, but the Muslims don't want Jews praying up on the Temple Mount. So they raised the stink, and just like with the Passover sacrifice this year, the government said, wall it up again. Nobody's to go in there. So these women, and I think men on occasion, pray at this point because it's as close to the Holy of Holies as they can get. But here we see these women standing and one sitting. Here's a common posture of prayer you do see in the church. Head bowed, hands clasped, eyes closed. Fine, no problem, long as it reflects your heart. Anyone can clasp their hands. Anyone can close their eyes. Anyone can bow their head. But your prayer should be a reflection of your heart. Your posture, I should say, should be a reflection of your heart. Again, here, this picture of a church in prayer, many different postures of prayer. We're trusting that each heart is lifting itself up to before God in spirit and in truth in this picture. So remember, clasping your hands together like so or whatever is not required. There's no prescribed posture of prayer. It's your heart that God is looking at. So this is not a required posture here. This is not prayer. This is superstition. Writing a note on a piece of paper and jamming it in the Western Wall is not the way to communicate with God. In fact, remember I showed you that this is done by email these days. You can do this from the States if you want to. That's hardly it's hardly turning your heart to God in prayer. I don't do that when I go to Israel. Is this prayer? It can be. Words in a prayer book, words written out, can be wrote. I've seen that. Definitely I've seen that. But they can also reflect your heart. And if the words you read from a page of a book or on a piece of paper reflect what's going on in your heart, then that will be prayer, because God looks on the heart. He looks on the heart. That's the thing we have to keep paramount in our minds, right? That's the essence of prayer. So here is Daniel, and he's praying on his knees with his hands raised to the Lord. All right, so Daniel was caught in prayer and brought to trial, convicted. And so Darius immediately had got this figured out. He was trapped as well as Daniel. And he tried all the rest of the day to get Daniel off the hook by finding some kind of a loophole. There we go. A loophole in the Medo-Persian law, which cannot be repealed. Finding none, he had Daniel in the lion's den. And here's an illustration of Daniel in the lion's den. Again, I love the lions, but Daniel is 80 to 85 at this point. He was no half-naked, you know, hunk. That's what we have here. I don't know where this guy got this. How come they always draw him half-naked like this, huh, you know? Anyway, I love the lions. This is the one. This is my favorite lion right here. This is the guy I like right there. The snoozing lion. And here's a Doré's woodcut of Daniel in the lion's den. Looks a little better. Daniel looks a little older here. And I found a picture of an abandoned lion's den in an abandoned zoo in England. It's where I believe this picture was taken. And this gives you a better idea of what the lion's den was like. Here, the lions would run free in this area down here. And this area is some kind of a gate. There's some kind of a gate that rises and lowers here, and some kind of a den in there. Probably put food in that den. The lions will go in and close it. You can clean the den outside, reverse it. The lions would come out. And up top here, spectators can observe the lions. Well, this is probably more akin to the type of den Daniel was put in. Some kind of a large opening at the top where observers could look at the lions if they wanted to, and the main entrance on ground level covered with that stone, something like that. All righty, so now we're with Daniel in the lion's den, and Darius goes home to have a very, very sleepless night. But before he leaves, to go back to the palace, he says, your God, whom you serve, will deliver you. There's a little bit of hope, a little bit of faith, perhaps, in Darius. So on page 128, point E at the top of the page, we come to the deliverance of Daniel, verses 18 through 23. So we'll begin in point A, the concern of Darius in verses 18 through 20. He's concerned over what he has just done. And so the night he spends is described in verse 18. Then the king went off to the palace, to his palace, and he spent the night fasting, and no entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. So ironically, Darius has a troubled night. He has a guilty conscience. Daniel has a restful. He has a clear conscience. Going, what in the world have I done? Daniel knows exactly what he's done. So, how is the night described? First of all, no food. He fasted. He was too upset to eat. The American Standard says no women. The word actually means entertainment, which most likely consisted of A, instruments, and B, dancing girls. But Darius was not interested in entertainment. And thirdly, no sleep. No sleep. Have you ever had a night like that? You don't want to be entertained. You don't want to eat. You can't sleep. Every minute passes, takes an hour for each minute to pass, right? You're looking at your watch and 30 seconds have gone by. What is this? You know? The night lasts a long time. So we all have had nights like that. Yep. So he's anxiously waiting for the morning. Apparently in the morning he can legally open the den and release Daniel if Daniel is still alive. So apparently the law allowed for that. So finally the morning comes in verse 19. Then the king arose at dawn, at the break of day, and went in haste to the lion's den. So the translation is fine. It literally means daybreak there, very early in the morning, first light, as soon as the horizon is lightning, turning bright, he rushes off to the lion's den just as early as possible. He probably can barely see his way, still needing torches to light the path. And when he gets to the den, he utters a cry in verse 20. When he had come near the den to Daniel, he cried out with a troubled voice. The king spoke and said to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions? On your outline, you see it's recorded as a lamentable voice. The NASB says troubled voice. The point here, he apparently expected Daniel to be dead. He,
I disagree with that. First of all, I think I'm going to see it. When you take verse 16, you get verse 16, verse 18, verse 19, verse 20, is sleepless and very, very concerned, not guilt, wanting this guy to be saved, and then again rushes out and believes, I really think the guy's saved.
You think he's saved? Okay.
I do.
All right, that's fine. Well, if he's in the kingdom, I'll be happy to see Darius. I don't know. I don't know if he was or not. Okay, all right. Thank you. Okay. All righty. So he says, he calls Daniel the servant of the living God because he knows whom Daniel worships and serves. He doesn't serve an idol. He doesn't serve something made out of metal or stone, but the living God who is active and involved in Daniel's life. And by the way, the living God who is active and involved in our lives as well. Never forget that, that it isn't just Daniel who's delivered from the lions. We get delivered from our lions as well. We'll talk about that a little later on. So he says, was the God whom you serve continually able to deliver you? So he's voicing his hope of verse 16. Was it fulfilled? Page 129. We get a response, a living response from Daniel in verses 20 and 21. And so here's another illustration of the lion's den. Again, probably not all that accurate, but it gives us an idea. There's Darius peeking in, calling out to Daniel. Okay, Daniel addresses the king in verse 21. Then Daniel spoke to the king, O king, live forever. He starts out with a conventional address. Probably not the way I would have answered the king. So his response, we need to note that his response is untroubled. You know, he says, hi. O king, live forever. Now, why is his response so untroubled? 22, verse 22. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before you, and also toward you, O king, I have committed no crime. So the means of escape. Daniel saw an angel. Doesn't describe the angel, but Daniel saw him. Was it a run-of-the-mill angel? Was it the angel of the Lord? Was it a theophany? Doesn't say. Doesn't say. We'll have to ask Daniel when we see him. But we know what the angel did, whether it be the angel of the Lord or a run-of-the-mill angel. He shut the lion's mouths. This is why he's so calm. You know, he's not in some corner, cringing back in some corner. Get me out of here! He's not up on a ledge, you know. Get me out of here! You know? Oh, king, live forever. You know? He's untroubled. These lions are no longer lions. They're kitty cats. I could just see him purring there, you know, rumbling. Not this little, like your kitties do. You know? He'd scratch him under the chin. Yeah. Question. Yeah.
He thought Daniel was so honorable, therefore the God of Daniel had to be just if not more honorable. So it's kind of like through Daniel he found something he couldn't figure out or touch upon, but he knew something was there.
Yeah, so we will see that right at the end of the chapter. You're right on. We'll see it right at the end of the chapter, Carolyn. Very good. All righty. So Daniel, just like you and me, at least I hope, none of us has fear of kitty cats, do we? No, Daniel's not afraid of these little cats, these pets, because their mouths are shut. And the reason he was delivered, point two, he says, I was innocent. So one aspect is that God honored his integrity. God honored his ethics. He was totally upfront, transparent. He didn't cut any corners. And secondly, I was not guilty of any crime against the king. And of course, this is proven by his survival. This shows without a doubt that the law was wrong, the decree was wrong, not Daniel. Daniel was right to obey God rather than men. And of course, Darius had seen this very clearly the day before. And so it's confirmed without question. The decree was wrong. So Darius responds in verse 23 to Daniel's sentence, Daniel's call, verse 23. Then the king was very pleased and gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found in him because he had trusted in his God. Point 3a, Darius is exceedingly glad. I can just see him going, yes, you know, and then dancing around in a dignified royal manner, of course, you know. Say again?
Did we see
I'm doing it right now. he was ecstatic. So he has Daniel pulled out of the den as quickly as possible. And so the law's been kept. The penalty's been imposed. The lions have been uncooperative. You know, it's like standing before a firing squad and the six guys aiming their M16s at you, fire, and they all miss, you know? You went before the firing squad, the law has been carried out. Now, Daniel's inspected, point C. I read that and I think of a security pat down, you know? Okay, Daniel, please get your hands out, legs wide, you know? Raise your hand. Yeah, they're looking him all over. And the result is no harm is found. And this reminds us of his three friends back in Nebuchadnezzar's furnace many years earlier. Remember, our three friends in the furnace? No harm came to them either. And so Daniel has no bites. He has no scratches. He has no bruises. And in the morning class, one student said, no fleas. Probably no fleas either. I hadn't thought of that one. Nothing. Nothing's wrong with Daniel. He's in perfect health. Now, I want you to highlight parentheses number two there. Double star it. Use your highlighter. Because he trusted in his God. This is the bedrock of his deliverance right here. This is the ground of his deliverance. His trust of God. His trust of God motivated all that he did. And of course, that's what inspires the writer of Hebrews. In Hebrews 11, 32 and 33, when he talks about the heroes of the faith. And what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, and David, and Samuel, and the prophet. What? By faith conquered kingdoms, performed act of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions. So Daniel is one of our heroes of faith. He trusted in his God. Point F at the bottom of the page turns our attention to the punishment of the conspirators in verse 24. Verse 24. The king then gave orders, and they brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel, and they cast them, their children, their wives, into the lion's den. And they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Well, we'll get to that. So now the tables are turned. And Scripture has a lot to say about the way we treat others and how our behavior will boomerang back on us. Proverbs 26:27, for example. Here's Proverbs 26:27. He who digs a pit will fall into it. He who rolls a stone, it will come back on him. So these conspirators had dug a pit for Daniel, and now they're the ones that fall into it. Say again?
Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Mm-hmm. The setup was worship.
Right. Oh, yeah. It's all worship.
This is also a setup.
Yeah.
So setup. It duplicates itself.
Yes. A lot of parallels. And Galatians 6:7 tells us very clearly. Galatians 6:7 picks up this idea. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, this he will also reap. If we sow discord and criticism and discouragement. What can we expect but get back into our lives? Discord, discouragement, criticism. If we sow love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, self-control, what will come back into our lives? Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, self-control. What we sow, we will also reap. Now here, in this chapter, in this example, we have an example of reaping curse for curse in kind. That's based on Genesis 12:3. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. So these conspirators were attempting to curse Daniel and the Jewish people. Daniel was the preeminent Jew of the day in Babylon, top man in the government. And so you can bet that any persecution of Daniel would have trickled down to the Jewish community in general. So point one, the accusers are cast into the den of lions. Daniel is innocent, but they're guilty of defamation. They're guilty of character assassination. They have brought false charges against the high government official. They've lied to the king. I'm sure you could go on and on and on and on and on. I'm sure Darius could come up with an old list of charges against these guys. So the accusers join the lions, but notice point two, along with the wives and children. Now this is probably the ringleaders' families only, probably not the 120 satraps, probably just a few ringleaders here. Now notice point A, punishing the wives and children is contrary to the Mosaic law. This was forbidden in Israel's Mosaic law, unless the wives and children participated in the sin. If the wives and children actively participated in the sin, they were guilty of the sin as well. But if they didn't participate in it, they were not to suffer the fate of the father. Here's Deuteronomy 24:16. Deuteronomy 24:16. Fathers shall not be put to death for their sons, nor shall sons be put to death for their fathers. Everyone shall be put to death for his own sin. Part of the Mosaic law given at Mount Sinai. The second cross-reference at the bottom of the page is an example of when the law was implemented. Now, it wasn't always implemented, but this is a case where it was. 2 Kings 14, verses 5 and 6. Now, it came about as soon as the king was firmly in his, Messiah that we're talking about, as soon as the kingdom was firmly in his hand, that he killed his servants who had slain the king, his father. But the sons of the slayers he did not put to death, according to what is written in the book of the law of Moses, as the Lord commanded, saying, the father shall not be put to death for the sons, nor the sons be put to death for the fathers, but each shall be put to death for his own sin. So this practice is not in keeping with the Jewish law, with Israel, but point B, it was part of Medo-Persian law. Was part of Medo-Persian law. Question. Well, that, first of all, is not within Israel. The Amalekites are receiving judgment for their attack upon Israel when Israel came out of Egypt. So this is judgment upon the Canaanites, judgment upon the Amalekites, etc., is not something governed by Mosaic law within the nation. Deuteronomy is dealing with Jew to Jew within the nation. Okay? All right, now why? Why would this be in keeping with Persian law? Well, we really don't know all the philosophy behind it, but it could be a deterrent to criminal activity because if you were caught and punished, you didn't just affect yourself. You know, if I get caught, my wife suffers, my kids suffer, everybody suffers. So it could be a deterrent that the Persians came up with, or it could be a way to avoid revenge. You know, the sons wanting to get after the people who executed dad. You know, we'll get even, that kind of thing. So it might have been a way to cut that off. But, again, we really don't know. All righty, page 130. Page 130 finishes up the verse by talking about the power of the lions. Notice point A. When the families are tossed into the lions' den, the lions had mastery over them. angels restrained the lions, they acted like kitty cats. It's as though they were muzzled and had a leash on them. Restrained, unable to act like a lion. But now the angel removes that restraint. Off the leash, and all of a sudden they're no longer kitty cats. They're lions again. And they act like it. And so they attack the people coming into the lion's den. They attack them immediately. They break their bones before they reach the bottom of the den. And point D shows us that the lions were hungry. They'd spent all night without any food, and they wanted some breakfast. But they were restrained from breakfasting on Daniel. And this emphasizes the miraculous nature of Daniel's deliverance. The lions are just acting like hungry lions. Nothing new. They're back acting like their old selves again. All righty, I've got a quarter till, so we will come to the decree of Darius after your break. So go ahead and take your break, and we'll pick it up when you hear the shofar. And we're underway. We're underway. The attendance sheet is going around. I think somebody's got it there. All righty. We're on page 130. And we now turn to the decree of Darius, point G, in the middle of page 130. The decree of Darius is verses 25 through 27. So point one begins with the salutation, the opening of the decree. Darius is just kind of a typical Middle Eastern monarch. He loves these decrees. He loves to get his opinion out there. All right, verse 25. Then Darius the king wrote to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language who were living in the land, "May your peace abound." So again, this goes out to all the ethnic groups, all the political groups, all the language groups. Point four, that dwell on the earth. That's the American Standard rendering, but that is a little bit too strong. It's a misleading translation. The NASB, the New American Standard, is better. Point A, it'd be better to render the word land. And in this case, the land, point B, is the province of Babylon or Babylonia. This is the land that Darius has authority over, province of Babylon or Babylonia. Okay, moving on to page 131. Page 131, the decree itself is developed in verses 26 and 27. Start in the first part of verse 26. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, and again, point A notes that this is limited to Babylon, not the entire Medo-Persian Empire. Second part of the verse. Men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and enduring forever. And his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed, and his dominion will be forever. So point one, he states that men should tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. In other words, they should respect the God of Daniel. Now prior to this, they did not respect the God of Daniel. They were to pray to Darius. So it's rather ironic that the one who made the decree to be revered as a god now nullifies that decree. Darius, who was showing disrespect for Israel's God by requiring prayer to himself, now nullifies that decree. And he gives us four reasons why. Point two, he's the living God. He's not an idol, not a hunk of rock. He's not Darius. But this is not a God made of stone or wood. Secondly, he is the steadfast God forever. So he seems to understand that God is eternal in his nature. He seems to understand the eternal nature of God with this statement. Point four, his kingdom shall not be destroyed. Now he's apparently talking about the messianic kingdom here and saying that it is indestructible. He seems to be understanding the times of the Gentiles to a certain amount. Where would he get instruction about the times of the Gentiles? Well, from Daniel. I'm sure he had many conversations with Daniel. And so there seems to be some kind of rudimentary understanding of the messianic kingdom. And then he goes on in point five to say, his dominion shall even be to the ends of the earth.
Is he considered a prophet
here? Darius? No, he wouldn't be considered a prophet here. He seems to understand that the God of Daniel is the King of Kings, that he's the sovereign messianic king. So there seems to be an understanding of revelation that Daniel has taught him. But notice point six, and I don't want to pop anyone's bubble here. Nothing he said here violates polytheistic principles. He has basically just said, instead of disrespecting the God of Israel, we need to respect him. But that doesn't mean you need to give up your idols. So he doesn't instruct anybody to forsake the lies of idol worship and turn exclusively to the true and living God as the truth. He just says, respect him. And worship your own God as well. So we cannot assume he has saving faith here. I hope so. I hope we meet Darius in the kingdom, but it's possible we won't. Oh, yeah, sure. Oh, yeah. Well, Daniel was very, very close to Darius. We see that Darius loved Daniel deeply, that he valued Daniel highly, and that's because Daniel's character was so exemplary and his ethics, his whole life was so exemplary that he was admired deeply. And so he was able to teach the king, you know. Yeah. Yeah, but if we live lives like that, opportunities like that can come our way, definitely. All righty, in verse 27, he goes on to discuss the works of God. He's described God as the object of reverence, the true and living God, but now he describes his works in verse 27. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. Now he delivers. That is a generic term for any kind of danger. Generic term. Earthquakes, robbers, illness, any kind of danger. Danger in the weather. Danger from man. Whatever. He rescues. This is a specific term for deliverance from an imminent physical danger, from a specific danger. In this case, of course, it would be Daniel facing those lions. And the fact that he works his signs and wonders on earth, in heaven and on earth, was proved in the fact that those lions changed from lions to pussycats and back to lions again in their personality, not their physical form, but in their personality. Now, this decree would have certainly encouraged the exiled Jewish community. It would have certainly encouraged them to trust in the Lord. And it more than likely squashes any growing anti-Semitism. If anything had happened to Daniel as a result of this malicious accusation, you can bet malicious accusations would have trickled down to the Jewish community as well. Well, that's probably why God is moving on Darius' heart to make this decree, protection for his people. All right, page 132, top of the page, we conclude the chapter in verse 28. Verse 28. So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. And we've looked at this issue briefly earlier on. Daniel prospered, A, in the reign of Cyrus, and circle that word, in the reign of Darius, and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Again, circle the word and, indicating they are two different people. But remember, you will run across commentators, maybe in your study Bible, maybe in a formal commentary, that prefer the rendering Darius even Cyrus, making them one individual. But the better rendering is, parentheses 2, Darius and Cyrus. Point 2, that Darius was subservient to Cyrus, Darius over the province of Babylonia, Cyrus over the entire empire. Two different men.
Isn't that supported by Herodotus?
Yeah, it seems to just be the better position all around, yeah. All right, point B, Daniel served until at least 536, and that would make him around 84, 85 years old. All right, the takeaway. What is the takeaway? Five lessons. Three of them are written down. I'm going to add two more. So point two there, the lessons for the Jewish community. A, the Jews in the dispersion will always prosper to a degree. And that's been true. Wherever we've gone, all over the world, usually we end up prospering one way or another. B, for this reason, we will always be endangered because of jealousy. And that has happened over and over again, especially in Europe, Roman Catholic Europe. But point C, star this, double star this. Put your highlighter over this. But the Jews will always survive due to the Abrahamic covenant. God has to fulfill that covenant to us. Add point D. There's room. Lesson D. When persecuted, stand firm. Dare to be a Daniel. Obey God rather than man. When put in a conflict between the state and God, stand firm, just like Daniel did. Dare to be a Daniel, obey God rather than men. And remember, as we get to the final lesson now, this event happened just as Israel is about to enter the Promised Land. We're poised on the return. Now, Cyrus may have already issued his decree allowing us to return, or he's about to. So that brings us to lesson E. Point E. Satan cannot stop the return of the Jewish people to the Promised Land. Satan cannot stop the return of the Jewish people to the Promised Land. He wasn't able to do it in 1948. He wasn't able to do it in 1967. Iran will not wipe us out in 2010. Here, in this chapter, Israel's most strategic individual was attacked. And yet he was preserved, and the return would take place. Remember, Daniel is the most strategic individual in the Jewish community at this time. And so he is preserved. Now, the question rises, did Daniel return at 84 or 85 years of age? No. Probably not. There is a Daniel mentioned in Ezra and in Nehemiah, but that Daniel is a Levite, and it's much too late. He's many, many years in the future. All right. Daniel has had to face down some lions, some literal lions. But does it stop there? The question I want us to ask now, how do we deal with the lions that we face? So I've got some slides to hand out to you, dealing with the lions that we're facing. Thank you, Craig. Got it? All right, thank you, sir. All right, this is a two-sided handout. I've got six slides here for you. All right, any extras here? All set there? All set here? Okay, everybody got one? Thank you, Craig. Wonderful. All right, what lions are you facing? Daniel faced his lions. We face our lions, too. Now, this picture of a lion is found very, very commonly in Scripture. And often, our lions come in the form of wicked men. For example, Psalm 7, verses 1 and 2. A Shiginon of David, which he sang to the Lord concerning Cush, a Benjaminite. I'm glad I'm not this guy, Cush. He's named here in Scripture as a lion. So this guy was persecuting David somehow. David says, O Lord my God, in you I have taken refuge. Save me from those who persecute me and deliver me, or he will tear my soul like a lion, dragging me away while there is none to deliver. So here we have this wicked man pursuing David, pictured as a lion. Same picture in Psalm 10, verses 8 through 10. Speaking of the wicked, he sits at the lurking places of the villages. In the hiding places, he kills the innocent. His eyes stealthily watch for the unfortunate. He lurks in a hiding place as a lion in his lair. See the picture of this lion stalking prey, looking for prey, looking for that innocent little deer for dinner. He lurks to catch the afflicted. He catches the afflicted when he draws them into his net. He crouches, he bows down, and the unfortunate fall by his mighty ones. I didn't give you that one?
No.
All right, write it down then. Write it down. Did you get it? Psalm 10, 8 through 10.
Yes.
Okay. Psalm 17, 8 through 12. Did I give you that one?
No.
Oh, I probably edited it down because it would have been too many pieces of paper. Psalm 17, 8 through 12. Write this one down then. Psalm 10, 8 through 10. All right. Psalm 17, 8 through 12. Shall we move on? All right. Psalm 17, 8 through 12. The psalmist says, keep me as the apple of the eye. That's a reference to the pupil. To the pupil, protect me the way you would protect your eye. He's calling out to God. Hide me in the shadow of your wings. That's a picture of a mother hen spreading her wings over her chicks. Hide me in the shadow of your wings from the wicked. So that's who we're talking about, who despoil me. my deadly enemies who surround me. They have closed their unfeeling heart. With their mouth they speak proudly. They have now surrounded us in our steps. They set their eyes to cast us down to the ground. He is like a lion that is eager to tear, as a young lion lurking in the hiding places. So we run into lions in our lives, don't we? Jesus also experienced the lions. He's been there. He's done that. He knows what it's like. That's why he can minister to us. He's been in the lion's den. Psalm 22 is the key psalm for that. He's being mocked on the cross, and he says, "They open wide their mouth at me as a ravening and a roaring lion." So the remarks mocking Jesus on the cross cut into his soul like the teeth of a lion. And then, of course, he describes the crucifixion experience under other pictures. We move on to another part of Psalm 22. He says, "For dogs have surrounded me. A band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierced my hands and my feet." And you know, there is an alternate reading to that. The alternate reading reads, "Like lions, they maul my hands and my feet." Interesting alternate reading, isn't it? Whichever reading you choose, the same idea is communicated, right? The mauling of the hands and feet. And then he continues describing crucifixion, and he closes, "But you, O Lord, be not far off. O you, my help, hasten to my assistance. Deliver my soul from the sword, my only life from the power of the dog." And now he switches to the picture of the lion. "Save me from the lion's mouth." So Jesus went into the lion's den for you and me. When he went on the cross, he was in his own personal lion's den. Well, how do you defeat the lions? Well, when faced with lions, call out to God for deliverance. Call out to God for deliverance. Psalm 35, 17. Psalm 35, 17. "Lord, how long will you look on? Rescue my soul from their ravages, my only life from the lions." Just as the psalmist called out, so we need to call out. Psalm 58, 6. "O God, shatter their teeth in the morning. Break out the fangs of the young lions." You know, so they can only gum you to death here. They can't bite you. Again, break out the fangs. Break their teeth. We have to call out to God. And that's exactly what Jesus did. That's exactly what Daniel did. So we conquer our lions by faith in the living God. And that's the example of Hebrews 11. We've looked at this before. "And what more shall I say? For time shall fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, and Samuel, and the prophets, who by faith..." That's how we conquer our lions. "Who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions." Though our lions can be a job loss, our lions can be cancer, our lions can be a divorce, our lions can be anything that gets thrown our way. But God is not so interested in what he puts us through as he is in our response to what he puts us through. And our response is to call out for him to deliver us from the lions that we face. Yes? Yeah, his lion's den was no picnic. He was not delivered. Daniel was delivered, but Jesus was delivered up for our sake. Yeah, Daniel was delivered up for his witness to Darius, but Jesus was delivered up for our sake. He went into the lion's den as well. All righty. I hope that's an encouragement to you. We finally make it to chapter 7. Chapter 7 of Daniel. Now, as far as our time frame goes, we're still in the prophet's present time, but now we're going to jump back to Belshazzar's court. We're going to jump back to just before the end of the Babylonian government, per se. Okay? So we're still in Daniel's present time, but we're backing up a few years. Now, you see point 7 on your outline, page 133, entitled The Four Beasts. Sometimes, you can put in parentheses here by chapter 7, verses 1 through 28. Sometimes this chapter is called The Little Revelation. The Little Revelation. And you see a lot of parallels here. All righty, this finishes up our chiasm, right? We've looked at chapters 2 through 6. The Gentile empires, persecution, encouragement, C prime, encouragement, B prime, persecution, and now A prime again, we get another look at the four Gentile empires. Now, this is an example of the law of recurrence. Remember the law of recurrence? We talked about it 20 weeks ago in your introductory material. So let's review it quickly. The law of recurrence. The law describes the fact that in some passages of Scripture, there exists the recording of an event followed by a second recording of the same event, giving more details to the first. There's your key. Giving more details. Hence, it often involves two blocks of Scripture. The first block presents a description of an event as it transpires in chronological sequence. This is followed by a second block of Scripture dealing with the same event and the same period of time, but giving further details as to what transpires in the course of the event. So the two chapters are not contradictory. They are supplementary. They need to be harmonized. Critics love to take this law of recurrence and twist it. You know, chapter 2 and chapter 7 are different. Ah, we got different authors. One in chapter 2, one in chapter 7. Oh, or Daniel blew it. Daniel made a mistake. Things like that. So they're perverting the law of recurrence, just ignoring it. All right, so this is an example of more information regarding the times of the Gentiles. So we begin in point A, page 133, with the introductory comment in verse 1. Verse 1. Chapter 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. Then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. All right, note the date. The first year of Belshazzar. So we drop back a few years here. We drop back to 553 BC. So this event occurs 50 years after chapter 2. Chapter 2 is the vision of the image, the man. 50 years later, Daniel now gets this vision. It comes 14 years, point 2, 14 years before the Babylonian government comes to an end and Babylon falls. So this is 14 years before chapter 5. So this shows us that this is a thematically arranged book. It is not a chronologically arranged book, deliberately so. The dates tell us very clearly that this is arranged around a theme, and the theme is the times of the Gentiles. Now, we 21st century Westerners don't like that kind of arrangement. We like our chronology. A follows B, or B follows C, A, B, C, D. There, well, now we got it. 1, 2, 3, 4. Two follows one. 3 follows 2. There, I got it. This is not biblical thinking and Middle Eastern thinking. Thematic thinking is much more common. Point three, Nebuchadnezzar has been dead for 9 years. He died in 562. And in that interim period, point four, three kings followed in quick succession before Nabonidus usurped the throne. After Nabonidus usurped the throne, he then made his son Belshazzar co-regent in 3 years. We went over that back in chapter 5. Remember this chart I gave you back in chapter 5? Nabopolassar was the first king of Babylon, followed by his son Nebuchadnezzar, followed by Nebuchadnezzar's son Evil-Merodach, who was then killed by Nergal-Sar. Nergal-Sar came to the throne, number 4. His son then followed, Labashi-Marduk. Labashi-Marduk lasted 3 months, I believe it was. And then Nabonidus took over. And after 3 years, Nabonidus then appointed Belshazzar as his co-regent. So we had a lot of political activity going on in this period of time. Quite a hectic time in the life of Babylon. All right, point five. Daniel is now 67 years old. And so this chapter occurs between chapters 4 and 5. Now, point B, the dream visions. This is the first vision given to Daniel proper. He's always interpreted other people's visions up to this point. This is his. Point two, the content is a further elaboration on Daniel 2, the times of the Gentiles. Expanding our information on the times of the Gentiles. Point three is a comparison between chapter 2 and chapter 7. Point A, the visionary in chapter 2 is a pagan king. That's Nebuchadnezzar. But in chapter 7, the visionary is a holy prophet, Daniel. The bottom of the page. Point B, the interpreter in chapter 2 is Daniel. In chapter 7, the interpreter is an angel. Page 134. Point C at the top of the page. There's a couple of different perspectives as well. Chapter 2 is man's viewpoint. And so all four kingdoms are majestic, right? They're this majestic image of gold and silver and bronze. But chapter 7 presents us the times of the Gentiles from God's viewpoint. And in God's viewpoint, the four kingdoms are beastly, animalistic. So I like this idea of comparisons. So I threw together a couple more slides for you, just from Dr. Constable's notes, just to highlight some of the parallels and comparisons between these two chapters. So let me hand these out to you. We'll quickly build these slides, and we'll quits for the night as we compare these two chapters. Thank you, sir. And we need two here. There we go. Oh, okay. All righty. And we need a couple here. Very good. Thank you. And we get enough here. One. All right. And we need one here. Okay. Everybody got one? And we have some extras here. All righty. All right, let's build these slides very quickly. Thank you, Craig. All right, chapter 2 and chapter 7, the feature, the chapter. As far as the kingdom goes, chapter 2 deals with the outer political aspects of the kingdoms. Chapter 7 deals with the inner moral and spiritual side of the kingdoms. As far as the symbol goes, inanimate objects are used in chapter 2 to symbolize the kingdoms. But in chapter 7, the animate world is used to symbolize the kingdoms. As far as human government goes, chapter 2 describes human government under the statue of a man. Chapter 7 deals with the animalistic nature of human government. And then the messianic kingdom in chapter 2 is symbolized by the smiting stone, and in chapter 7 by the coming of the Son of Man. And the second chart that I gave you, chapter 2 and chapter 7. Chapter 2 dealt with Nebuchadnezzar's image. Chapter 7 deals with the four beasts. In chapter 2, the dream is given to Nebuchadnezzar. In chapter 7, it's given to Daniel. In chapter 2, we get a look at four kingdoms plus a fifth one, plus one. In chapter 7, we also look at four kingdoms plus one. In chapter 2, the dream consists of the image of a man and a stone. In chapter 7, the images or the dream is four beasts and the Son of Man. Chapter 2 is more general in nature. Chapter 7 is more detailed in nature. Chapter 2, Daniel interpreted it. Chapter 7, the angel interprets it. And again, chapter 2 is from man's viewpoint, and chapter 7 is from God's viewpoint. Okay. Point C in the middle of the page, and we'll call it quits for the night. The recording of the dream. We're told in chapter 1 that as soon as Daniel woke up and it was fresh in his mind, he immediately wrote it down. He didn't want to forget any of it. But point 2, what he wrote down for us is a summary. It's not all the details that he saw in the dream. So when I get with Daniel in the kingdom, I'm going to say, all right, buddy, give me all the details. I want to find out everything you saw there. So this is just an overview, the most important features of that dream. All righty, that brings us to a close for tonight. We'll pick it up in the middle of page 134 next week with the vision itself, with the vision itself. All righty, let me close in prayer, and I'll let you go. Father, again, we want to just stop and thank you for your word. And I want to thank you for this idea of the lions, Lord. Again, as we've explored that idea of the lions that Daniel faced, the literal lions that Daniel faced, the lions that Jesus faced, and the lions that we face, are all conquered by faith, by trusting you, by calling out to you, by waiting on you to break the fangs of the lion and deliver us. And we saw in Jesus' case, we're not always delivered from the lions. There's always a purpose. So, Lord, help us to remember that the overriding principle here, whether we're delivered or whether we have to go through the lion's den, is faith in you, trusting you. And you will bring good out of all you bring into our lives. And we will grow in our relationship with you and grow in our trust in you and grow to be the type of people you want us to be. So help us share this with the world around us so that we can be your good and faithful servants and bright lights in a world that doesn't know how to handle lions. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.